session number 28698, Reel 6.
Major Lawton, Reel 6. 6 months is up and you return to Colchester?
Back to Bianni Barracks in Colchester in preparation to prepare for handing the colours into DLI Cathedral, into the Durham Cathedral, and also the prayers in all the DLI Freedom Towns of Sunderland and Hartlepool and Stockton and Barnacastle.
A busy period for you.
Yes, it was, extremely, because as the marching troops were learning to do the parades and everything else, and we moved it to Diebold Camp, which was a derelict camp in Barnacastle at the time. Of course, there was people left in Colchester preparing for the handover of the barracks. And we knew then that the DLI silver and pictures and paintings and chattels were going to get split between other regiments of light infantry as well. So there was a lot of background movement going on, but the majority of the battalion were in Barnacastle preparing for all the freedom parades.
And they took how long? What kind of period are you looking at?
Oh, we're working all day long. Well, first of all, we had to move into Diebold Camp, and after chasing the sheep out, put the barrack blocks in some kind of order and go further into other camps in Barnacastle to get lorry loads of coke and coal, because it was still the old potbelly stoves and the wooden huts. So we made it habitable at first, then we build our kit up, then we go each day in the back of Bedfords, be to Hartlepool, to Stockton, to Sunderland, and we do our freedom marches. And of course the culmination was the 12th of December in Durham on the Palace Green.
And at that point in time the regiment ceased to exist?
Well, we're still existing as 4LI. Yeah. And when we hung the colours up and moved back to Colchester, it was at that period then people would be moved off and get the post noticed to the various battalions and regiments of their choice.
And you and others stayed at Colchester because you were...
In my stage, I changed from C Company 4LI to B Company 2LI, and it was now getting into February and March of 69 now. And then during that period, the advance party of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, or now 2LI, had moved into Colchester.
So you come together?
And we were coming together, and we were then the formed 2LI, and that was about March now, March of 69.
Who was commanding officer?
A guy called Snag Sibbald, Colonel Sibbald, Big Red, or whichever other name you want to call him, and he was a commanding officer, and he was KOLI.
What was he like?
He was absolutely good, and he welcomed us and gave us all the speech, and said that he needed the influx of the DLI soldiers because he was a few men short and we were putting the men in. But he made us welcome to his battalion. Although we didn't think that a few weeks later, like I said earlier, when people were getting in trouble, we seemed to think we got the harsher end of any discipline stick.
Obviously, the structure would be the same.
The structure was exactly the same. The companies were exactly the same. The blocks were all numbered the same. But we had very little time to shake out before we were told we were going to do some preliminary training for the jungle, and then we were going to Malaya to the Jungle Warfare School, where we would carry out jungle warfare training as a battalion and then follow this up with exercise Salon, a tri-nation exercise.
Just before we move there, you were in B Company. Who was your commanding officer?
Oh, a guy called Ella, Major Ella, again, who was KOLI. And Tom Jones was our Sergeant Major, who later became our RSM. Tom Sergeant was a guy called Tiny Greer, 6'6" man, a monster of a man. And again, he was KOLI. But most of our corporals were our DLI corporals. Ray Nottingham and a few others.
I was just wondering whether DLI men had been kept in companies and Kings Own Yorkshire's in other companies.
No, we were merged straight in and mixed, and we had a mix of our corporals and their corporals. It just happens that the company commanders and some of the senior ranks were mostly theirs at that particular stage. But then we got diluted down because we're all in B Company to start off with. And then some went to A and then some went to D. And we filled the gaps in where we were required within the KOLI or the 2LI battalion.
So you said you just a short time, and then you did this initial jungle training. What form did that take?
Well, we went to Thetford, a place in Thetford, in Norfolk, and we did basic how you operate in the jungle. Sign language, everything was silent. Sign language, how to put your bashes up so they're no more than a foot and a half, 2 feet off the floor, how you would eat and drink, how you go and collect water out of streams in velour bags, how you would filter it so it was clean to drink, how you would cook in the field without making too much smoke, how you do your night routine so there was no smoking or no fires, how you put perimeter fences around your basher area so you wouldn't get lost in the jungle at night, how you patrol in the jungle, how you would operate in the jungle. So we did all that pre-training before we physically got to the jungle.
Which brings me to the point I should have mentioned, is the patrolling. Was this something you'd been training in with the previous battalions? Had you actually done patrol training?
Well, most training that we'd done with the Durhams and that, and the exercises we did with the DLI, was all Northwest Europe orientated. Because the jungle is almost in single file, so a completely different complex. So this was starting a brand new type of training from scratch.
What type of patrols would you have?
Well, you do all the recce patrols, going out, locating, lying in silence, mapping the area out, doing all that kind of thing, fetch the information back. Then, if you knew the enemy there, then you would form fighting patrols and you would go out to fight that enemy. Or you go out to do defensive patrols to make sure you were there and the enemy didn't come to fight you. So all the training of defence, withdrawal and attack were all practiced and rehearsed. Remember, some of our older corporals and sergeants had all been in Borneo. That was KYLI and the DLI lads. So people like me were going in from scratch, but we did have some experience within the older element of the battalion.
And they would be a great asset, presumably.
Absolutely. Although we're moving on now because we're now looking at jungle warfare training, not as Borneo, but as Vietnam. We were going in to do Vietnam-type warfare.
So there must have been some idea somewhere of the hierarchy that we could have been pulled into Vietnam, presumably.
Well, it was certainly muted, if you want. But the commandos, 4-2 Commando and 4-40 Commando, who were stationed in Singapore, in Kluang and Nee Soon, they had been over there for months and months digging into the hills, as the Vietnamese did. And we were going out there to root them out, as the Americans had to do. So all the training was was centred around Vietnam. So again, it was all new training for all of us.
How long did this initial training last?
There were 2 weeks exercises and 3 and 4 week exercises. And then we really launched straight into Malaya.
And with these exercises, did you have an enemy?
Within our own battalion.
Within your own battalion.
A company would go against B and B against C type thing. So it was all internal training.
And you said it was all sign language?
We had to learn to join sign language because once we got the jungle, most of the stuff in the jungle would be silent drills, all on sign language. So rather than waste time in the jungle, wasting precious time, if we learned all the preliminaries before we got there, we could physically get in the jungle and get on with the training.
What date was this then when you left for Malaya?
It was in March, May, round about May 1969.
And was it just the battalion that was leaving?
No, there's your artillery elements were there and your engineer elements and all the rest of it. But we were physically going as a battalion first to do infantry jungle warfare training. We went the infantry jungle warfare training school in Malaya at Johor Bahru.
How did you feel about going abroad?
Absolutely good. I couldn't wait for it. And if I say anything, I was more at home in the jungle than most places I've ever been. The experience was out of this world.
Can we come to the journey itself? How did you get there?
We all went by plane. I think it was all Britannias that we all went out. But we had to fly into then Cyprus first, and then across to the island of Gan off the Indian coast, and then from Gan to Singapore and landed at Changi. and then we were taken from Changi in transport up to Johor Bahru.
Where did you fly out from?
Bryce Norton.
And that would be the first time you'd ever been on an airplane, presumably?
No, we'd already done Cyprus.
Oh, that was... Because you've flown to Cyprus.
Because we were flown to Cyprus as well, yeah.
How did you take your first flight then? Is it, again, an adventure or a frightening experience or what?
Well, it certainly wasn't frightening, but it was certainly an adventure. Because the first time I went to Cyprus on the exercise, we'd gone in on the old... twin prop aeroplanes, where you had to land at Marseilles, refuel, then hop across to Malta, refuel, then into North Africa, refuel, because we weren't allowed to fly over Libya, of course, in them days, and then from North Africa into Cyprus. So we had to go around in a big circle over airspace that we're allowed to fly over instead of direct, because we weren't allowed to fly over Libya in them days. So, in fact, we ended up in Cyprus on this 6 weeks exercise, having to land on in Malta for 3 days because we couldn't take off for sandstorms in Africa, so we had to stay in Malta for 3 days.
And the Britannia aircraft, I think you mentioned that you went to Malaya in there. Were they comfortable? How were they arranged for?
No, they weren't comfortable, and the flights were about 23 hours long then as well. That's why you had to stop at places like Cyprus and that. One to refuel, but two to get a break, because they were long journeys.
So how did you do it? I mean, 23 hours includes meals and nature and so on.
Well, you're stopping. I say we landed in Cyprus, then Cyprus to the island of Gan, which was a very small island. In fact, the runway went from east to west, so you touched down and you just say stop before you came off the other end of the island, and then you flew on to Singapore.
And did we allowed off the planes when you were...
Yes, you had to get off, and then you went for a meal. That's how you got your meals and everything. Your meals and stretch your legs and everything. Then it was a head count back on, and then onward journey, onwards and onwards.
And what was the seating arrangement in these aircraft?
On them particular ones, they were as per civilian flights, because they're really, in a way, civilian aircraft.
So they were reasonably comfortable in that respect?
Yeah. But and then we land in Singapore, you'll be met there, you get the international briefing of customs and religions and stuff like that. Then we picked up by transport and driven up country to Johor Bahru.
Had you received any inoculations for these journeys?
Oh, yeah, your yellow fever, your tetanus, your malaria and everything else. Yeah, it was 3 in one arm and 3 in the other. And of course, we'd been on a 3 week pre-flight of taking Paludrin for malaria. So your body immunity was already built up before we got in country.
And then prior to going, you got this?
Oh, yes, 3 weeks before you went. Then every single day at about 8 o'clock in the morning, you had to pop a Paludrin and sign for it. Because it was the Army's way of saying, we're giving you all the preparatory medication possible. So the fact if you spit it out later, that wasn't your problem. The platoon sergeant had your name down that he'd popped a pill into your mouth at 8 o'clock every morning.
Any side effects from these inoculations and tablets?
No, not at all, no. And I don't think anybody else did either. Not that I know of.
And was this Paludrin an improvement on what they'd used prior to this?
Oh, yes.
It turned yellow and...
Paludrin, you took a test, it's absolutely horrible. But as far as I know, I can't remember anybody having malaria.
What was your first impression of Singapore?
Singapore itself? Well, it was a few weekends before we actually got down to Singapore, because that was, again, our weekend rest and recuperation. But smelly, monsoon dishes were always full and fairly stinking. We used to sleep at the Bridge Club and drink at the Union Jack Club. Or was it the other way around? Yeah, the other way around. The hotel was the Union Jack Club. We used to drink in the Bridge Club. Singapore was absolutely brilliant. Wide streets, again, far from the smell. And, of course, you still had Bogie Street and Arab Street. And you know the reputation of these streets. You could never find them in the daytime. You used to have to travel everywhere by trishaw or taxi. And if you tried to ask them to take you there through the day, of course they wouldn't. But we spent many a wonderful night in these streets. And again, it was so educational. It was really, really good. I think it was wasted because you'd consume a large amount of Tiger and Tiger Tops beer that I think we wasted a lot of times. There was one particular weekend we went down to Raffles, and I think we went in the front door and we're shown straight out the back door. Wrong type of clientele. But no, Singapore was wonderful apart from the smell. I mean, good session on a Saturday night, and you get up on a Sunday morning and you smell the street and then, oh, terrible. Not like it is now. It's perfect. The cleanest spot on earth, I think.
These streets that you've mentioned were the women of the night, were they?
Well, they weren't all women. It was the old Bogey Street, the Catamites, Kai Tais, Transvestites, whatever you want to call them. Yeah. But entertaining, it was absolutely brilliant to see how these men physically and mentally looked like women and in their minds were women. Brilliant education it was.
I'm going to say it must have been there. What was the response to them? Did it push them around?
Our particular group, the guys, and we were all still DLI lads, that were in the dorms together and stuck together through 2LI. We took it as education and we'd take little recorders like that and they would sing. And a lot of them were students and they would have the full operations for whatever type of life they wanted. But they were very educated and they would talk to us and they would sing to us and they'd do all kinds. I mean, and they were there if you wanted to...
Homosexual
relationships. And that's what they were there for. And funny enough, just coupled with that, there was obviously cigarette packets of drugs you could get at the drop of a hat. And I never saw the soldiers touch that neither. And you get the odd flustered soldier come back and say, God, I've just come out that lift and I went to make advances on this girl and found out she had a bigger pair of balls than I did and embarrassed. So some did used to get embarrassed because in my way, you say, you could tell if they were a man, they were slightly taller and better looking than the women.
Were these Malaysian people?
Both Malaysians, Chinese and Eurasians, yeah. But some of them were absolutely beautiful. But as we used to get drunk, we used to say to each other, God, don't let me fall in love with the one in the red dress or anything like that. And we literally used to look after each other. But I'm sure other people did get caught out and found out. And yeah.
So you went up to the training area, did you say that?
Yeah, we did a lot of our training in Ulu Tram, which is Jungle Tram, the name of the jungle, and up in the mountains and in the jungle. And you get introduced slowly and slowly, and then you'd extend your periods of staying in the jungle for the first few weeks. Then after that, you'd go in on a Monday morning, and you wouldn't come out till a Friday night. And by then, half your kit would drop off your back, and your boots would rot on your feet. And a lot of it was secondary jungle, and hard going. I loved it. A lot of people hated it, because the noise and the clicking and the creaking all night long, and the monkeys and the birds and that screeching. I physically loved it.
And obviously, by that, some people found it very difficult to cope with that.
Well, the SES still do. That's why they do the jungle warfare part of their training last, because they just can't handle the jungle.
But creepy crawlies and snakes and whatever they have, I don't know.
Everything. At one time, as you're cooking your food and everything drops in your food and you're trying to flick it out, after a couple of days, if it falls in, it goes down as well. But leeches crossing rivers and hanging on bushes are the biggest fear, I suppose. And everybody, I've got little marks all over where I've got leech bites. Because I'm not a smoker, so I could never light a cigarette up to burn them off. Although salt and insect repellent would make them pull their heads out.
But were you issued with insect repellent?
Oh, yes. You always had insect repellent. You spray it on all the seams of your clothes because it would last on the seams longer. If you put it direct on your shirts, and you would just sweat it all out because you were soaked with sweat or soaked with rain 24 hours a day anyway. So we used to put it in the seams of your clothes and it used to last longer. But leeches and mosquitoes were the biggest. Everything in the jungle bites. All the plants have spikes and they stick in and rip you to bits. You have plants called wait a while because when you get stuck in on it, you can't get out. You've got to like back off it. And beluca, which is like the ferns and the heather that you've got to go through, which is 6 and 7 feet tall. Everything rips at your clothes and your skin and your body. Everything, the mosquitoes, the ants and everything bite. Everything takes blood out. You're in the jungle. But I still loved it.
What you must have had different type of clothing to what you'd been.
Jungle greens, which is more or less your Airtex jungle greens. In Cyprus, it was khaki denim, exactly the same material, but it was khaki colour. In the jungle, it was all long and it was green in colour. And you wore jungle hats instead of berets.
Slouch hats.
Yeah. And you always wore a neckerchief to keep the ants from dropping down. And it was also your sweat rag to completely keep cleaning yourself off. And jungle boots, which were supposed to stop your leeches getting in, but leeches, depending on what size they are, would get through the lace holes and everything. And they, of course, they were three-quarter leg, or, you know, long-legged calf boots, yeah. But and you were wet all the time. And you always had two sets of clothes here in the jungle, and one you kept perfectly dry under all conditions, because that's what you had to sleep in on a night time.
How were you able to do that if it's so damp and wet?
Well, you still put your poncho up, because we now had ponchos instead of the old gas capes now. And you'd have ponchos up, and you had little beds called lilo beds that you could actually blow up. We never used to use them, because it used to make far too much noise. It's like a swimming float with tubes in. Absolutely far too noisy, so nobody ever did them. But what you could do was make, raise your bed off the floor by making a pegged out area and putting branches across, so at least it'll lift you a couple of inches off the floor, so the spiders and the snakes and anything else going underneath you would go underneath you and rather than over you. But having said that, I was in there. We used to dig in, just like Vietnam as well, and cover you, so you had a little hole to get in, and you'd holler underground and you'd sleep under there. And I was in a basher with a guy called Harry Gill, and he was complaining that he was being bitten and it was hurting, and he was more or less. And in the jungle, like I say, there's no noise. And I kept saying, shh, no noise. And he says, you'll have to put your torch on. And we used to all carry little pen light torches. So I put the torch on, and there was an army of red ants coming, and they were halfway across him, and they were literally eating him and all his clothes at the same time. We had a bomb burst out of the hole in the ground, and poor Harry was just about had half his skin stripped off him. But in the jungle, after about 5 o'clock at night, you can't see your hand in front of you. That's why you have a perimeter fence round. So we got round to where the gun was all night, and we dusted him down and got all the ants off him. And next morning, he was in pretty bad state. And then when I crawled back in the hole the next morning when it got daylight, all the ants had gone. But all our shirts, where it had the insect repellent and all the seams, the collars fell off, the pockets fell off, the epaulettes fell off. They're just about eating everything on the way through. Luckily, they were coming across Harry, and I was on this side, so they hadn't got to me. And old Harry was in a bit of a bad state, actually. He recovered, but the ants were eating them as they were coming along.
So the conditions weren't... I mean, for a westernised person living in England, it must have been quite a horrendous experience.
Well, again, I say to accept anything that goes, so it didn't bother me. And it didn't bother hundreds of other people, and it did bother some. But then you'd go into some swamps where you would sleep, and you'd be covered in rats as big as terrier dogs. And other air company couldn't move one night, because by the time they woke up next morning, they were covered in snakes. And you had to lie there till the sun got hot enough to come through the canopy to warm the snakes up, which would wake the snakes up, and they'd slither off. But lads were waking up, and you had these lightweight... sleeping bags, which is like a sleeping bag liner, very light material, and put it up and put it in your pocket, and the snakes would be inside with the soldiers getting warm. So you had to more or less open it up, let the sun get in, warm the snake up, and then the snake would go away by itself. But rats and things like that, and wild boar every now and then. You'd be in an ambush position doing your business, and wild boar would come thundering past you, and good experience.
When you say you put a perimeter fence round there, what did you mean by that?
Well, you would always try and get there for 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you'd say where you're going to put your bashers, and you put them in a triangle position, one platoon, two platoon, three platoon, with a gun at each corner. So if an enemy came, at least you were surrounded. And then somebody, you would chop through the trees a path a couple of feet wide, right round from the corner to the corner in that shape. And then you'd put a green string from tree to tree to tree to tree. So you could walk around on a night time and follow your string. And what you must never do is leave go of that string. And then at each point of each triangle, you'd have a machine gun, and there'd be somebody on guard with that. So you'd be sleeping inside the triangle, and you would have another string from you to that, if that was your gun, and you needed to be able to get from there to there in the dark without getting lost. Or if you had to go from that gun to that gun, you'd follow that wire down, or that wire to that wire to that wire to that wire. And people still have got lost. And the idea in the jungle is, if you leave go of the wire and you don't know where you are, steer. Because if you think, oh, I must have come left, so I'll walk back right, you could be wandering anywhere in the jungle and you'd be lost forever. So once you lose your bearings, you stay where you are, because somebody coming on stag 2 hours later, coming under guard, at least you would hear them walking by. And you'd say, stop, I'm here, and they'd find you. Because whatever you do, you don't put any lights on.
What do you do for nature then, the cause of nature at night?
You would, hopefully you do all that before it gets dark. You would eat before it gets dark, you'd have your last cigarette before it gets dark. You do everything before it gets dark. Because unless you want stag at night, you don't move in the jungle. So from 5 o'clock at night till 6, 7 in the morning, you don't go anywhere. And neither does the enemy most of the time, because you can't get through secondary jungle anywhere. So you might say, you're just getting ripped to bits by forcing yourself through the jungle. It's not like Tarzan or anything like that. Everything's close knit. So if you go to the toilet, you go behind your own little tree somewhere, you dig your hole, you do your business, you cover the hole up. And wherever you take in the jungle, you fetch out as well, because wild animals will only dig it up and give away your position.
There must have been problems with fields of fire, though. I mean, you're literally hanging by trees anyway, even in your camps.
But even so, doing that, we'll still carry the mortars in. We'd man-pack mortars, although you'd have to have a clearing to shoot out of. But you would rely on... I mean, we used to carry shotguns as well. And during our training, we actually took on the American M16s, because they were all right in the jungle, because they were short-barreled weapons. And our SMGs were all right in the jungle, because they were short-barreled. But if you had trackers and guides, you'd carry shotguns, because they were easy to use. The SLRs would be cumbersome, because the trees are so close together. So short-barreled weapons were always far better. And you always had to use your golic to get through the jungle.
That's your knife?
Your knife, yeah. Your machete, yeah.